My name is Annie Powell, and I am a doctoral student at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. My discipline is systematic theology, and my special focus is womanist theology. We are now at the concluding session of Contemporary Voices in Liberation Theology. We've talked about feminist voices, womanist voices, Hispanic or mujeristas voices, and Asian American women on yesterday. And today our session is on gay, lesbian liberation theology. Is it Christian? And I want to start out by just fessing up, as we say in my community. I represent one of the most homophobic persons I've known. And I think as Christians, it's almost impossible for us to live in this society and not be homophobic, just as it's impossible for whites not to be racist, or men not to be sexist, or for all of us not to have some kind of prejudice, whether we know it or not. Because homophobia is so ingrained in our society, like those other types of oppression that I mentioned. I was taught by the church that homosexuality was wrong. All the scriptures I ever read said that they seemed to condemn the, homosexuality. So I never bothered to think about it for myself, to tell the truth, or to seek out any gay and lesbian persons to try to get to know them or learn about their culture or anything else. And one of the most embarrassing incidents in my life, in retrospect, is when I publicly humiliated and condemned a black lesbian woman. We were both students in undergraduate school at the College of New Rochelle in New York. She belonged to the Metropolitan Community Church, and she was an ordained minister in that church. And so every day she used to come to school wearing her collar and pants too. I was against that, wearing pants, you know, you're supposed to be a Christian woman, you know. And so anyway, we were taking the same counseling class. And on this particular day, I don't remember exactly how the subject arose, but we were discussing homosexuality. And I lit into her like white on rice. I told her that she ought to be ashamed of herself, that she had no business calling herself a minister, as long as she identified with the homosexual community. And, you know, she just ought not to even think about calling herself a minister of God. And the sad part, as I look back on that experience, is the fact that the whole class cheered me on, you know, with nods of approval and and yes and amen and that sort of thing. And a few years later, God began to deal with me about my homophobia. And I started to look at the scriptures again and still didn't find too much support for changing my belief in the scriptures. But I knew that the Spirit of God was compelling me to try to get more information. And so I began to seek out persons in the community. I was a student at Union at that time too. Who had identified themselves as lesbian or gay. And I asked them, I just told them up right up front, I'm scared, I'm ignorant, and I feel awfully strange doing this. But I want to learn more about you. I want to hear about your experience as a gay or lesbian person, whichever I would be talking to, you know, male or female. And I'm interested in having some conversations with you, perhaps over breakfast or lunch, if you can or will. And so another bill, okay.
It's for the bus.
Oh, okay, that feels better.
You're not done yet.
You missed this bus.
And I was scared, I really was scared. Even to have breakfast with the, especially the lesbian women, I was okay with the men, you know, because you make a mistake. But, as I have done in the past, but with the women, I didn't want to be perceived as lesbian, and I really didn't want them to hit on me, so to speak, you know. Somehow I had this mistaken notion that all lesbian women try to seduce straight women. And so I was a mess. But anyway, I started then to talk to different persons who were willing to talk to me. And I learned a lot more about their experiences and their culture and so forth. I also took the initiative to start looking at different books I could read to help me to gain even more knowledge. And I had done some of that reading even before I went, you know, I approached these individuals and asked them about being in conversation with me. And so what happened was everybody I approached, whether male or female, they were so happy that I had enough interest in what was going on with them and wanted to become more informed so that I could really be in active struggle with my homophobia, that they did everything they could to really explain parts of their stories to me, talk about their coming out experiences, talk about their call to ministry and other things that I could really relate to. But the I think two things really helped me an awful lot. And one was my experience of cancer and reading Audre Lorde's books. Audre Lorde is a black poet and also a lesbian woman. And she wrote several books, one called Sister Outsider, which talks about different parts of her life and her journey. And also Cancer Journals and A Burst of Light, each of which talks about her experience of cancer. And when I started reading the Cancer Journals and A Burst of Light, it seemed like everything else just kind of faded away, and all that was left was me in dialogue with this woman who had had an experience of cancer, which I was struggling with at the time. And so the black didn't matter too much, except that I felt that she was telling the truth. You know, sometimes when we read the works of other races, we may not think they take blacks into consideration, but because she was black, I felt that she was speaking primarily to her black community, and then, you know, to all women as well. So, but the thing about the lesbian part, that's what I'm trying to get at, because that just didn't matter anymore. It was her message that was important, and it was her message that was sustaining and encouraging me to keep on living and to want to live in spite of my experience of cancer. And not only want to live, but want to thrive. And so, it just meant so much to me that she, as a post-mastectomy woman and also a person still struggling with cancer because hers had metastasized, had this much strength and this much power to do what she was doing, still being so isolated within the African-American community. And the other thing was, you know, just having known people. I had one friend in particular at Union who was so deeply spiritual. And when I first met her, we were in a practical theology class together. And I didn't know she was lesbian. So, I mean, we had already become friends before I found that out. And she is such a gifted minister and dancer and just has so many talents, which she uses to glorify God in the same way that I called myself using my gifts. And so it was in these kind of relationships that helped me to see and believe that something was wrong with my way of thinking, and that I had to go back and re-examine it and just, you know, to think for myself and not allow the views that had been put on me before to rule my life and the way I related to the gay and lesbian population. So about 4 years ago now, I suppose, I asked God to give me the courage just to stand up for what was right, to stand up for righteousness and justice, as Martin Luther King used to say. And the first time I did that was in the context of the African Methodist Episcopal Church Congress, Educational Congress. And I was so scared, but it was as though I just could not keep quiet, because one of the ministers who was given a workshop was talking about AIDS. And the way he presented his information made it seem like gays and lesbians were responsible, or the homosexual community was responsible for AIDS, and if you didn't indulge in homosexual activity, then you wouldn't have to worry about AIDS. And of course, anybody who has any real information about AIDS knows that is not true. And he went on to say that in the context of counseling a bereaved family, that when he got ready to do his sermon, he was going to tell it just like it is. They're going to tell that they died from AIDS, and gonna tell that that they were gays, and that's the reason they had AIDS, you know. And I just, you know, could not sit down on that one. I wanted to, because there were, you know, so many people there, and it's always so much easier to hide and get the person off in the corner later, and let's talk privately. But I said, you know, it's too important for me to let it go. And so I said to him, first of all, that I thought it was important that we not suggest that AIDS is just the product of the homosexual community, or that heterosexuals could not get it, you know, as long as they didn't indulge in homosexual activity. And secondly, if you're not going to question persons who die from other diseases or preach about that, then why would you single out a person who is gay or lesbian and talk about the cause of their death, and then, you know, pronounce judgments upon it? It's just not fair. And so, strangely enough, someone else spoke up on the same issue, you know, and just kind of followed it up as that not being sound counseling. And so that was the beginning of my speaking out. And I've been trying to do more and more of that as I go along, but still realizing that I'm in the struggle. It's not over. And just like whites are still struggling with racism, and men are still struggling with sexism, it's not something that you say, okay, well, I have a consciousness now and I'm going to do something, and it's over. It's a lifelong process, and you continue to struggle. And so I just thought that it was important for me to say this up front so that you would have some sense of where I'm coming from. I don't want to claim that there is no trace of homophobia left in me, because then, you know, I set myself up as being perfect in that respect, and that is far from the truth. So I just thought with that kind of honesty, maybe you can respect me and respect what I'm saying a little bit more. And so we want to start with somewhat of a history of the gay and lesbian movement. and then talk about some of the persons who are doing theology, gay liberation theology, that is. And if we have a chance, we want to wrestle with some of those questions on the sheets that I passed out or had passed out. Did everyone get a copy? I need to know. Oh, so if there is a way to have more copies made, that would be helpful. But otherwise, maybe you could share with someone else. I brought those copies from home, and not knowing how many people would be in the class, Margaret did not make copies in advance. So, anyway, when we talk about the history of the gay and lesbian movement, we are talking about essentially three waves. The homophile movement from 1951 is the first wave, and the goal was integration. And second is the gay liberation movement of 1969, and the lesbian feminist of the 1970s. And so just to say a little bit more about that, take a look here at my notes. This first wave, the homophile movement, is associated with the New York chapter of the Mattachine, M-A-T-T-A-C-H-I-N-E Society, I'm not sure I'm saying it right, and the Daughters of Bilitis, B-I-L-I-T-I-S, in 1956. And the second wave is associated with the Stonewall Riots, influenced by the New Left, the Women's Movement, and the Counterculture Movement. Also associated with the Gay Liberation Front and the Gay Activist Alliance. The third wave, the lesbian feminist movement in the 1970s, represented a banding together of feminists and lesbians to form radical lesbians. And this is also influenced by the women's movement. And I think it's important to say that the National Organization of Women refused to be associated or identified with the feminist movement. Now this first wave, the homophile movement, whose focus was on integration, believed that education and research would help them to achieve liberation. And the early activists believed that prejudice and stereotyping, etc., were the main source of homosexual problems, and therefore education, policy reform, aiding individual homosexuals, etc., would bring about the recognition that there's not much difference between the hetero and homosexuals, and therefore we have should have equality for all. Was also influenced by the NAACP. And so when I think about the integration aspect of the movement, it takes me back to the civil rights movement and King's emphasis on integration, you know, but still recognizing that integration was not enough. And so anyway, the movement's change in perspective and goals changed its perspective and goals over time when these goals were not achieved. You know, King started out with one stance about the nonviolence in the civil rights movement, but that was when he was in the South looking at segregation and had not looked at some of the other things that were going on in the North. And, you know, when he started to look at those things, then he had some reservations as to whether liberation could be achieved simply through the nonviolent movement that he espoused. And so the same thing is going on, or a similar thing is going on in the gay and lesbian movement. They see that so many of their goals have not been achieved, even after they have tried to focus more on educating the public and especially the heterosexual community. So they wanted to try something else. And unfortunately, this took the shape of the Stonewall Riots in June 1969. The police decided that they were going to close down the Stonewall Inn, which was a gay bar in Sheridan Square in Greenwich Village. And instead of submitting, the patrons, the gay men and lesbians began to shout, "Gay power!" And around 2,000 people assembled in Sheridan Square in protest of police brutality. Now, I don't feel comfortable to say some of the things that they said, but maybe just to help you to get the sense of the anger and pain that was being felt, they said one of their statements was that nobody is gonna fuck with me. I ain't gonna take this shit no more. And so this, you know, this whole attitude that grew out of that Stonewall, all out of the Stonewall riots, created conflicts with the homophile movement. And so now there's dissension within these two movements. So anyway, to get on to the heart of what came out of that was something similar to what happened. Again, I have to go back to my own experience in the Black Power movement. Gay power, Black power. Okay, you're just sick of the junk. You're just sick of it, and you don't feel like you want to accept it anymore. You want to stand up and claim your right to life and your right to all of the benefits, just as anybody else. And so the words that came out of that that was so important were gay pride, you know. And this gay pride, could thinking of yourself as somebody important, understanding yourself as created in the image of God, could give them a sense of self and make them want to go on and not deny their homosexuality, you know, in order to be part of this society. So now the third wave was the lesbian feminist movement. It emerged in the spring of 1970 in New York City with the evolution of radical lesbians committed to both women's and gay and lesbian liberation. And they formed the Lesbian Feminist Liberation Incorporated. There's a lot more to be said about that, but because of time constraints, I want to move on to something else. In 1980, they were faced with the gay community was faced with the spread of AIDS. And as you know, as long as it was thought to be in the gay community exclusively, not much was done. And so gay and lesbians especially gay men, took an activist part, an activist role in trying to both help themselves and also to fight for legislation that would make more aid available for research so that there could be some kind of relief of the suffering among this population and other people. I think if more had been done, if we hadn't been so homophobic about the whole issue of AIDS in the beginning, then we would have been able to produce the type of literature about prevention earlier and not after the fact. The way it turned out with so many people, not only among the gay community but heterosexual community as well, ended up having the disease, and it had to hit the heterosexual community before any real work was done. And so I just think that's pitiful, but then don't we all? So gay liberation theology comes second. The reflection and the struggle are important here. They have a great emphasis on praxis. Don't just think about it, but get out here and do something about it, or put your theology in action. The focus is reminds me of the Latin American focus, because the theologian must be part of the community, and this way you are immersed in the community of gay and lesbian persons, and you speak out of the experience of that community. So it's not as though you are sitting somewhere, or just say not as though I'm sitting somewhere reading some condemnatory scriptures and doing my theology without ever having been in the community of gays and lesbians, and without ever having talked to anybody. This is the way our history got distorted. Always coming from the ruling class perspective without talking to the people who were enslaved at all. And so it's just such a one-sided thing. So one of the things that gays and lesbians emphasize is the importance of the praxis and being the theologian being part of the oppressed community. Now, I want to, Dan Spencer has written, the key question for churches today is not how can one be both gay and Christian, but on what basis does the church continue to perpetuate violence and injustice against lesbians and gay men, denying the reality of the experience of God's love in our lives. We know that the church has long ignored sexuality as a theological issue. Just sexuality, period. Forget about homosexuality. We won't even talk about sexuality in the churches. That's one of the reasons that I formed these questions for us to discuss, is so that we can talk about what is really going on in the churches about this issue. So the church is not interested in dialogue, period, it seems. They just say procreation is sexuality's main function and homosexuality is the main sin. And that's the end of it, you know. That's a pronouncement. So going from the way in which earlier theologians have viewed sexuality as something evil, I mean, the church has just internalized that, and we have come to almost devalue ourselves as sexual creatures. And this is even more true in communities of women, because the women's sexuality was more evil than men, you know. There's just a whole lot that that churches need to be doing. So now I want to say something about the some of the persons who are doing gay liberation theology. I have two main people in mind. One is Gary Collins. No, I'm sorry. Gary Comstock. He is the author of Gay Theology Without Apology. This is a new book, fresh off the press. I haven't read it all, but I read enough to see that he begins speaking experientially, and then he deals also with the Bible. He does not discard it as one of his sources, but he does claim that he would read the Bible from a critical perspective. Comstock is a union graduate, the same school I attend. He's a former worker in the gay men's health crisis and was one of the activists in the gay power movement of the 1970s that I mentioned earlier. And so I just want to share with you some of the ways in which he reads the book of Leviticus, because that's the main book that many people use as a basis for condemning homosexuality. And what he does is first tries to examine the scriptures and then to understand its purpose. And so he says on page 62, the book of Leviticus, its narrative theme of the sojourn at Sinai is concerned with instituting the rules of worship and daily life, the duties of priests and familial land tenure after the future arrival in the promised land. Unlike other books, Leviticus is less of a story and more of a collection of statutes, ordinances, laws, and commandments spoken by Yahweh to those gathered at Sinai. And he says, I first began studying Leviticus because it prescribes death for male homosexuality and yet welcomes and loves the neighbor and the stranger. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination, Leviticus 18:22. If a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall be put to death. Their blood is upon them. And this is the same book, chapter 20, verse 13. These two verses may seem small and insignificant in a book of 859 verses. Even the list of other sexual offenses of which these two verses are a part are neither numerically significant nor a major theme in Leviticus. Also in Leviticus, the penalty of death is not limited to male homosexuality. Other such punishable behaviors are cursing parents, adultery, incest, marrying both a woman and her mother, bestiality, wizardry, harlotry, working on the Sabbath, cursing the name of Yahweh, and murder. Nonetheless, the gravity of capital punishment, even if mentioned only once and not limited to homosexuality, provoked my serious attention, especially because for our own times, prescribing both death for gay men as well as love for the strangers seems contradictory. How can one both love and kill those who are other, marginal, outsiders, or strangers? And that is a good question for us to think about. Now, he goes on to talk about the way in which the book of Leviticus is seeming to set up exclusivity, superiority, and protection, and otherwise that patriarchy that we've been talking so much about this week, which puts a certain group of males at the center and everyone else on the periphery, serving this group of males while they maintain this father knows best attitude, father knows best for everybody. You don't know anything about yourself. Daddy knows. So daddy will make all of the decisions and tell you what's good for you. And so anyway, he cites other passages in Leviticus 20, verses 22 through 26, which you can read for yourself. But what I wanted to point out here is that he says, anti-homosexuality would appear to have been part of the community's effort to separate and distinguish itself. Elsewhere and throughout Leviticus, the privileges of a priesthood, of unblemished, married, heterosexual males, the inferiority of the female gender in sacrifices and ceremonies, and measures protecting sexual ownership of women by men reinforce exclusivity, hierarchy, and patriarchy. And I think it's important for us to really consider what he is saying seriously. So he feels that it's important for him to look at these scriptures, try to understand their purpose, and to also to understand how they can help us today. Positively, you know, what can we glean from these scriptures today? And what he does is to try to look at parallels in the way the book of Leviticus is written, and the way in which those unwritten laws exist for homosexuals in the United States today. And he makes it very clear that even though you read and appreciate what you read, that does not mean that you have to accept it, especially if it's something that's denying your full humanity as a person. But what is central to me, anyway, is that he does use both experience in the way that most liberation theologies do, and also he is interested in trying to hold on to the Bible as one of his sources. Now, Carter Hayward does much the same thing. She's a lesbian feminist, and I didn't focus too much on trying to say a whole lot about lesbian women separate from the gay men, because the lesbian women are included in feminist theology. And so they didn't really have to construct a whole separate theology in order for their voices to be heard, although they did have to raise the consciousness of women in the feminist movement who were anti-homosexual. So as they began to confront, in the same way that African American and other women began to confront the feminists about their homophobia, then they had to consider what was being said seriously, and if they were sincere about creating a theology that was truly liberating, then they had to move from their homophobia, or at least be in struggle, and to include lesbian women in the movement. And so you will find lesbian women writing within the feminist movement, and black lesbian women writing within either the feminist movement or the womanist movement. And they are there always to prod us and let us know, hey, you're not treating me right. You are hurting me. And if you really want to live up to your name of being about liberation, then you have to examine what your actions toward me, and where you find that you are denying me my full humanity, then you have to make some kind of change. How much time do we have?
We have 15 minutes.
And okay, so there is one other person, Michael Clark, whose theology I wanted to share with you, primarily because Michael Clark is writing from a post-Christian perspective. He is a white-collar professional who claims that his pay is comparable to that of a pink-collar clerk because of his homosexuality. He was an ordained minister in the Methodist Church, but was not allowed to practice within the Methodist Church. And so he established a gay synagogue. And so when he does his theology, he is not even claiming to do it, to use the Bible as one of his sources, except to say the ways in which the Bible condemns homosexuality. And on page 18, this article that I have comes from his book called A Place to Start: Toward an Unapologetic Gay Liberation Theology. And so I just want to say a couple of words about his perspective, one of which is what theology must do. And that's on page 18. He says, taking seriously our historical and biological life and its limitations, as well as taking seriously both the limits of divine power to rescue us, and thus our responsibility for action, for fusing theology with radical participation, also means our gay theology will not ignore age, tragedy, or death. No gay theology will hold our attention, much less our respect, unless it confronts both homophobic violence and AIDS. And he talks about the paradigm shift in doing theology, whereas in classical theologies has been kind of a vertical, you know, approach. He's saying let's do a horizontal shift here, because there's just no basis in the scriptures. You know, you don't have anything in the scriptures to affirm you if you're a gay person. And so he says that it's up to the gay community to take the matter of justice into their own hands and try to relate to the rest of the world in a way that will help the realization, will help that justice to become a reality. And I just want to stop here, and if you have any other questions to let us talk about these questions for just a little bit. It'd probably be just enough to scratch the surface, but something is always better than nothing, in my opinion. So, would somebody read the first question, please, and just see if we can get a dialogue going.
Do you regard human sexuality as a blessing from God or a curse? Why or why not?
Respond to that. I'm a sixth grade teacher, and we are required to do AIDS education along with in our sex family life units. And the first thing we do with our students is ask them to define sexuality. Only sixth graders, there's a lot of giggling and tittering with that, and they eventually come up with something. But the definition that we share with them is that human sexuality is our maleness and femaleness. It's who we are and how we relate to the world. And that it has, and a part of being male and female, of course, is our sexuality. But sexuality, we define it too narrowly in the world. So we need to broaden that and realize it's just our maleness and femaleness.
Is it a blessing or a curse?
It's a blessing.
All right.
Being male or female is a blessing.
All right. Thank you. Anybody else want to respond to that?
I think we always say that, and we intellectually believe it, but how we practice it and what we say to our kids as we raise them, or when we look back at ourselves being young, how you never brought up certain things around your parents, and you would never say that to your mom, and she would never understand you. And the way it plays itself out is that it's not a blessing. And that follows you until marriage, because marriage is okay,
yeah,
and good and affirmed by the church. But whatever sexuality is going on or being practiced before that is not good.
Okay. We have one more over here.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's involved here is that so often when we see that word sex, that's all we think of.
Yeah.
Whereas sexuality is everything that goes to make up the person.
Right. Okay, Carol.
Because I have not been the victim of incest or rape or blatant, obvious, life-changing sexual harassment, just the subtle kinds of sexual harassment, my sexuality has not been a curse for me. But if I were, if I had lived a different life, I don't know if I'd feel the same way about my sexuality.
Your sexuality has not been what?
It has not been a curse for me. It has been a
curse. Blessing. Okay.
But I think that's because of my life experiences.
All right. All right. What's the next question?
Are lesbians and gay men really a part of God's people? Are they people? Should they exist?
All right. Let's deal with that one. Did you want to respond to that?
Yeah. I just, talking to my brother-in-law, Adolf Hitler said no. And we all think that he killed Jews, but he killed homosexuals and gypsies and a lot of people systematically. Christians.
Anybody else?
My home church in Seattle just became a Reconciled congregation, and there was, you know, a year's worth of discussion and conversation and work on that within the congregation, and I think that probably the thing that came through most clearly is, you know, just the reminder that we're all God's children and that no one's excluded from that invitation, and that as a church, we've chosen to put limits on who we think is God's child, but that God has never limited that.
Okay.
I think it was just a real good experience for our whole congregation to go through the discussion.
Good point.
The question, are they people? I have a friend who is a counselor and does a lot of counseling with, he's a Lutheran pastor and does a lot of counseling with gay people. His question to them when they first come to him is, well, what else are you? And forces them then to list the whole litany of other qualities as a human being that they are. And it's just that question, when my friend told me that's what he asks, clarified a whole lot of things about, are they people?
Should they exist? With all the gay bashing that goes on, some people obviously think they shouldn't exist. So, I mean, what do we think?
I think they, you know, certainly they exist, and all people are a creation of God, and I know it's not, I perceive that it's not a popular thing to say, but I do believe that homosexuality, the practice of that, is sin. I truly believe that. I believe that the Bible supports that. That does not and should not exclude those individuals from the church. And I should not judge what they are, what they do, because there are sins that I have, and one is not greater than the other. But I do not believe it to be Christian to want the church and to want God to condone my sin and allow me to not repent of that sin. And, you know, whether it's gossip or lying or cheating or murder or whatever it is, I think sin is sin. And it's wrong to judge. All people are God's people. And what you are and what you do are two separate things. And I think that's where it starts to get muddy, is I think a lot of people have made homosexuality part of what they are rather than something that they do.
Oh, are you saying that you don't think homosexuality is part of what a homosexual person is? I just want to be clear.
No, I don't believe it is.
It is part of who they are.
I don't believe that it's
part of who they are. Oh, you don't
believe it is. I believe that it's what they've chosen to be.
All right. That's the point I wanted to be clear on. Someone else want to respond to that?
Well, I've been writing to a homosexual man of about 30, and that's his sexual assignment, he feels, is to be a homosexual. But he also feels convicted and as a Christian, and he belongs to a rehabilitation group going through 12 steps, so he doesn't practice what he wants to do.
But I find that a very presumptive thing as a parent of a lesbian daughter who...
Could you speak a little louder, please?
I find that a very presumptive attitude on the part of Christians, because how do we know? Where do we get the information that practicing heterosexuality is somehow on a higher plane?
Well, it isn't.
And
it is adult.
Well, I think the key thing in both of these issues has to do with exploitation, respect, violence, the kinds of qualities that people bring to relationship. And there are the qualities that we can affirm from a Christian point of view in all relationships, and there are the qualities that we need to speak against. And I don't think the key has to do with whether one is practicing. I find, as having a daughter who would have loved to have gone into ministry, the fact that she can be a minister and she'll sign a piece of paper and say that she's never in a loving relationship with another person, that's very presumptive on the part of the church, I think.
Well, I was surprised that he shared that with me, that that is the way he came out. I didn't suggest or lead him, nor anything like that. It was just an insight.
Well, there are all grades and shades of this, because we all carry the baggage of the culture and what we've been taught. You know, I had to unload a lot of baggage in order to love my daughter, as I knew I was going to do as a parent. And what makes me angry is that there was so much baggage to unload, you know. That's not an easy thing to do, and yet was I going to abandon? I mean, nothing about this child had changed except what I knew about her. Okay. The person hasn't changed.
Tyrone, and then the lady in the back.
I find the dialogue very helpful, and the most instructive part has been your personal testimony, your fessing up, as you said. I was a commissioner to the 205th General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church, and every year with the issue of ordination of homosexuals come up, and this was my first time in 22 years of being a Presbyterian minister that I was privileged to become a commissioner, and it was a big privilege for me to go there. The predominant issue, although there were multiple issues that we had to address, was one of the issues was the ordination of homosexuality. And it was quite an experience to go through. Gay and lesbians came from all over the country, from the church, to be there, to remind us that they are very much there and will be there in the future. And they asked to have the privilege of the floor to address the assembly. And the assembly, there were 618 delegates voted no, which I thought I was shocked that we would not even give them the privilege to talk to us, to address us. Fortunately, about 20 minutes later, our moderator was bold enough to take the position of his being a moderator to allow them to address the assembly. And that was the most instructive part of the entire assembly, about 40 or 50 men or women who were a part of that community or family members came up to the microphone, giving about 15, 30 seconds of personal testimony. That was the most instructive part of the whole assembly. And what we eventually came out of a lot of hours of study was that we will study the issue 3 more years. I mean, that's what we decided the last time. It's dumb. But we did add one thing to it. We said we will study in dialogue. Oh. And the dialogue is very, very important. Now, Presbyterians, I don't know about Lutherans, we're very good about studying things. but you're at an entirely different level when you dialogue, when you can talk. And I sat in one of the subcommittees. I call it the sex committee, because that's what they talk about on the sexuality. Right? And they talked for approximately 10 hours. It was like watching a soap opera about creating a safe space where people can really talk and not become victims of their personal testimony. And we concluded that there was no such place if we were going to stay true to our Constitution. And so the irony is that even say we'll dialogue, there's no place that you can dialogue, because people say, well, we have the Constitution and we have the Bible, and if you are take that risk, we will punish you. And it's just very contradictory that we don't even want to talk about it, period.
Thank you for sharing that. Okay.
Like you, I had the experience of knowing gay and lesbian people. And in fact, I currently work with a woman who is a radical feminist, very open about it. And I'm a teacher, and she's a teacher. And so she isn't being repressed. She uses every opportunity to express her point of view. I think the difficulty we have as people, and where we're very different from our Creator, is that our Creator created us, but He also knows who we are. And He's able to love us.
in spite of some of the things that make us unable to love one another. And I think that the trouble we get into when we try to become loving is that we think the only way we can love someone is to approve of everything that they do. And this is where I think we get into the problem. We have a real problem as Christians when we try to look at the scripture and to say that our experience negates it. And I think what we have to do is take our experience and look at the scripture and say, how does the scripture instruct my experience? And it's difficult for us to do, and I think we're always going to struggle with this. But I do believe that's why we're having this difficulty. And I think if you won't listen to people, or you think because they're different from you, you have the right to attack them, oppress them, or not listen to them, that's definitely not supported by scripture. I think, though, that if you say that if you're going to respect them and listen to them and have them as your friends, that you have to approve everything they do, and you take, you know, homosexuality out of this. Say your best friend is an alcoholic, or your best friend is a consistently compulsive overworker or something. You know, that doesn't mean you can't associate with them, but you don't want to affirm them in an area that you believe is not healthy for them as a human being, psychologically, mentally, or whatever way. So depending on where we're at in our theology, that's probably where the struggle is going to be. Because personally, I am a very strong Christian in the sense that I take this, what the scripture says about homosexuality, and I believe it. But that doesn't mean that I have the right to disassociate myself from those people. Those are my friends. Those are people I work with. And I love them, and I feel their pain. So we don't have to make an either-or choice, I don't think.
No, and I don't think you should, to devalue them as people.
No.
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned. Oh, good grief. Okay, David.
Well, I think one of the difficulties that we have is knowing how hard it is and how late it has been that we have even begun to understand homosexuality. Chuck Jenner just yesterday in this room, you know, spoke about the genetics of homosexuality and how only recently have we begun to understand how much of this is genetically affected and so forth. The writers of the Old Testament were far less understanding even than we have been about homosexuality. And I believe that many of the passages which we cite opposing homosexual activity, comes from an understanding that homosexual people and behavior were unnatural, impure, didn't allow the kind of things that you were describing,
yes,
the protection of patriarchy and so forth. So that they were, homosexual acts were condemned as unnatural and therefore wrong. My view of it is that people who are created in God's image as homosexual people, it is natural for them to be attracted to one another, to same-sex relationships, and to have same-sex sexual relationships. It would be completely unnatural, and I believe a denial of our daughter's godliness to tell her that she's okay if she has sexual relationships with men to whom she has no affinity at all sexually, but it's not okay for her to love a woman. And I think that as we come to understand more and more that homosexuality is a part of God's creation and that it's natural, that we accept not only homosexual people, but we accept the sexuality which they were created with as part of God's image, and that to recognize that for a homosexual to love another person of the same sex is perfectly acceptable in this diverse world which God has created, as it is for me to love my wife.
We want to hear one more over here, and then here if we have time.
I want to reemphasize what I think to be the underlying principally are urging on us, which is that in dealing with these issues, we seriously try to say, what is it that we can do as Christians, that we can do in response to the scriptures? And the issue is such a heated issue in our culture today, and I personally been involved in a case of my campus where we, in effect, were thrust into the spotlight by conservative political voices who saw a way of making a lot of attention. And it's, you know, it's become such a heated issue, it's so polarized, and polarized between those who say, let's protect the family, and those who say, I need my rights. And there is such a need for the church's voice to say,